Tyler, you got a little bit of a break from interviewing for this episode, yeah?
Yeah, well, you know, I get kind of tired too sometimes, and really I wanted to see what was going on in Europe. So I threw it over to one of our European outreach scientists.
Yeah, Benoit.
Benoit, yeah. He works mostly in London, I guess. Yeah, we're based right outside of London, but he goes all over Europe.
Where do you head for this trip?
For this trip, he actually stayed in the London area and went to talk to somebody at Imperial College London, Dr. Tom Ellis.
I think I know him.
Yeah, he's big in synthetic biology.
Let's hear what he and Benoit had to talk about.
All right, let's dive in. Today's episode of the AdGene podcast features guest host and AdGene European outreach scientist, Benoit Guiquel. Traveling from our offices just outside of London, it was a short journey for Benoit to interview AdGene Advisory Board member and professor at Imperial College London, Dr. Tom Ellis. Dr. Ellis does research in synthetic biology and bioengineering, including a recent effort to construct a synthetic yeast chromosome. Listen to learn more about Dr. Ellis, synthetic biology, synthetic chromosomes, and obstacles to becoming an academic researcher.
All right, welcome to our AdGene podcast. And so today we are with AdGene depositor, which is Dr. Tom Ellis from the Center for Synthetic Biology and Innovation at Imperial College London. So, Tom, how are you today?
First good, of all, yes.
You're good?
A little tired, but good.
All right. So maybe we can start by, describe yourself and how did you end up at Imperial College London?
Yeah, I'm a research group leader in synthetic biology, which I'm sure we'll get to in a bit. I have a background in molecular biology, primarily has been the subject that I studied most of my career. And the way I sort of progressed through my career was starting at a pretty young age, working in the Cambridge area, which is where I lived, for companies and research institutes, just as an intern and doing little bits here and there and getting paid, before going and doing a degree in molecular biology at Oxford, and then a PhD using molecular biology for pharmacology reasons in Cambridge. Then worked at a company for a while, startup company, only for a couple of years, and then went on to do a postdoc in synthetic biology in the US before coming back to the UK. I was actually doing a postdoc in Cambridge. I'd only just sort of got going on it, a really interesting postdoc project, back in 2009 when I was approached by Imperial College, who were hiring specifically for new lecturers in synthetic biology, people to start running groups at our Center for Synthetic Biology and Innovation here. So it was a quick transfer then at that point to take up that position. And so for the last 7.5 years, mm-hmm. I've been building up a research group here.
All right. And what drives you academy and career goals? What drives you to?
It's an interesting question because part of me wants to sort of say, like, okay, I have this sort of holy grail idea that I would like to strive towards. And there is, I do have some of those in a way. So my first ever trip into molecular biology when I was 16 years old was working for the Human Genome Sequencing Project, loading gels and looking at the DNA bands coming through. And I remember at the time there, you know, I saw my contract the other day. I have a copy of it still, £3 an hour. and we were seeing all of these. I mean, the discussion at the Sanger Center, which is now the Sanger Institute at the time, was how many genes are going to be in the genome? 100,000, 120,000. And even during my time there, which was only sort of working weekends for a year and a bit, it became kind of obvious that a lot of the DNA we were sequencing didn't seem to mean anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't encoding genes, it wasn't promoters. And I've kind of always been fascinated by then what is this DNA doing? What are the alternative roles for DNA other than encoding proteins? And I feel that as a sort of ambitious goal in my lifetime, it would be lovely to understand two things, which is, one, what does every piece of DNA do in a genome? What's the point of it? And the answer being junk is acceptable in some cases, but I'd like to know which ones really are junk and which ones aren't. And the second goal then is, if you have as much of that knowledge as possible, could you sit down and build up a genome from first principles, saying, I need these genes, I need them switched on and off at these times, and all of those other things that need to be considered for running a cell. And so could you ever build up a genome from scratch? So those are sort of the big career goals. But, you know, day to day or month to month, what really drives me is just the fact that scientific investigation and engineering biotechnologies is kind of like puzzles. You know, mm-hmm. you have problems to solve, you have to think creatively, and, you know, I'm sure many people who are scientists or engineers were very into building things and problem solving as kids. Yeah. And, you know, I always liked Lego and math puzzles and things like that. And so, you know, to some extent, running a research group is just getting to do that for a career.
This is good.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier that you had a brief experience as a scientist in a startup company. So how does this help you in your current position as a lecturer?
I finished a PhD, and in the UK, the PhDs are pretty quick. So mm-hmm. I handed in my thesis after 3 years and a month, and was, you know, 2 months later starting out in a research lab. And I immediately got to do something that probably most postdocs don't even get to do, even after their third or fourth postdoc, if they go that far, which is get given a completely empty room, a budget, and told, this is what we want to achieve, which was to screen the ability of chemical structures to bind to promoters on DNA in a sequence-specific way. Develop the, you know, bring us the assays you would use to do that, and if you can, develop them better so that they're done at a more industrial scale than the way they were done. Here's a, you know, £50,000, here's a catalogue, here's a phone. On day one, I didn't even have a chair or a computer. So the first thing to do is get on the phone and buy a chair, buy a computer. So I learned what it takes to build up a lab, what it takes to bring in new techniques, what it takes to optimize those techniques and really, you know, do things like design of experiments to look at all the possible things you could change that might make a method better and more reliable and give you more data. And I also learned, you know, what it takes to integrate within a company, so there was other parts of the company that were already well established, mm-hmm. and how to report regularly and the importance of lab meetings. That was all quite valuable. Most people might be like, okay, well, I totally understand lab meetings. We have to have them all the time in my group. But actually, in my PhD, my supervisor was close to retirement and spent half of the year flying an aeroplane around New Zealand, which is about as far away as possible, literally, from Cambridge, where my PhD was. So I really didn't have many lab meetings and was very much, just my PhD was run by the occasional phone call plus an email here and there. Other than that, it was the work of myself.
Okay. And so what career advice would you give to someone that pursuing a similar academic career path?
Yeah. Don't do it. being an academic is not as well paid as industrial equivalents. It's not as easy to have a work-life balance as commercial, industrial, or publishing equivalents. So, for example, if you instead become an editor for a journal or something like that. However, it is attractive, right? Because there's flexibility and you're going after your own ideas. Now, if you're at the right biotech company, you get that as well. And at the company I worked with after my PhD, there was a lot of scope for us to come up with our own ideas, which was nice. And actually, after my first postdoc position in the US, I was most keen to go into industry, to synthetic biology startups or synthetic biology SMEs, rather than an academic career path. A major reason for that decision at that time was my father's an academic in a totally different subject, and I still remember just how hard and how much of his life it takes up and how much travel and what impact that has on people with young families. And I guess when I was a teenager, my thoughts would be I would never go down an academic career path based on what I was seeing my dad having to go through. Now, you know, things turn out a bit rosier at the end of a good academic career, right? So he's having time of his life now and still a professor. And so now I see it and I think, like, okay, maybe it's worth it in the end. Okay. But, you know, he's had a good ride. Not all of us academics will necessarily have a good ride.
So that's why you came back to the academy after your first idea of doing your career in the industry.
Yeah.
Then you came back to the academy.
Really changed at the point, which was about 2008, 2009, was I just needed another job, and there weren't that many jobs going in commercial industry around synthetic biology that didn't require US citizenship or being on a green card path already, because most of the synthetic biology jobs in the late 2000s outside of academia were all in the US, and I couldn't get a visa. So I interviewed for a few places and they all said, we'd love to take you on, we could give you really good roles, but there's no visas left in California this year, so sorry. So I just literally just went, okay, well, yeah, I need a job. I'm getting married. So I went back to being a postdoc. And then pretty soon after taking that, I was offered position to run my own group here at Imperial. I'm not going to turn that down. It was a great offer.
Yeah. And so now you're in your reader at the Center for Synthetic Biology and Innovation here. And so what is this center and what is its goal?
Yeah, so the center was a research grant that Dick Kitney, Paul Fremont, and some others wrote back in about 2008-2009 to get funding from the UK, from a research council called the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, EPSRC, to have the first sort of center for synthetic biology in the UK. There's now quite a few centers for synthetic biology, but I think what was really good about the application that they made here and the way this one was funded was it specifically said we're going to have a dedicated shared space and we're going to hire 3-4 young academics to bring synthetic biology here. Whereas a lot of the synthetic biology centres that are now established more recently in the UK just sort of identify people who are some in synthetic biology, some sort of partly in synthetic biology, and bring them all together and just keep funding their research, but not physically bringing them together and not sort of bringing in new talent. So almost, 2010, I guess January the 1st, 2010 was my first day. And myself, Gibart Stan, Travis Beyer initially, and Karen Polizzi, we all sort of set up shop in a shared space together and said, right, you know, it's time to start some synthetic biology off in the UK. So we all sort of discussed amongst ourselves what sort of projects we'll do together. We're sharing lab space, so we obviously collaborate a lot. We bring different expertises. So my expertise I was bringing was more the foundational science, molecular biology, how to build things, how to do experiments. Other groups concentrating on applications, and other groups concentrating on bringing, you know, mathematical modeling and computer simulations into the projects. So the Synthetic Biology Center was really set up to try and accelerate synthetic biology in the UK by having good foundational research and getting that into some early applications and maybe generating some startups, and at the same time training the first sort of British generation of synthetic biologists through an MRes program, through undergrad teaching, and through PhDs that we've supervised as well. I think we've been very successful. It takes about 2 to 3 years to start seeing the impact, but then we've had multiple startup companies spin out from people who've been in our center. We've had several of the postdocs and PhDs that we've had us doing research in our center are now starting or already running their own research groups around the world, not just here in the UK. And we've had a lot of success with our teaching, and particularly with supervision of iGEM teams. And obviously research publications have been pretty good as well.
Okay. And so you were talking about synthetic biology. Can you explain what it is exactly?
So my definition of it is it's really about engineering biology and trying to do that primarily at the DNA level by treating DNA as sort of the coding language of biology, which itself is a sort of controversial statement, because is DNA the coding language, or is it the written history of evolution? It's a bit of both. But I don't think many people would argue in biotechnology or molecular biology that if you rewrite DNA, you can get cells to do new things. Mm-hmm. So in synthetic biology, we try and do that not in an ad hoc way, but rather it by following sort of the discipline of an engineer, of trying to exploit modularity when we see it, enforce standards wherever possible so that people can better build upon the work of others, be more about sharing of resources and reporting the data that other people can use it. And what drives trying to do molecular biology and biotechnology through an engineering framework is really that the scale of our abilities to put together DNA or to just literally synthesize DNA and write it has vastly increased in the last 10 years, partly because of how much DNA information is available online through genome sequencing, through AdGene even. And so if you're faced with so many possibilities of ways you could rearrange DNA, ways you could rewrite things, then the best way to make progress is to say, okay, well, let's start to establish some sort of rules that if I want to do this, I repeatedly do the same thing every time rather than do ad hoc every time. Mm-hmm. And that allows people to build upon each other's work a lot quicker, including our own work within our own group, the fact that something someone does on one project can then be recycled and used in another project is very important to us.
Okay. And so what type of research projects, research project are currently underway in your lab? So there are several on your website.
Yeah, I would say that broadly my research group is working in three areas. So the longest standing areas are yeast synthetic biology, particularly rewiring regulation in yeast, bringing in new metabolism as a demonstration of what you can do if you can do standard modular assembly, so bringing in different modules of DNA, and then trying to scale our abilities to do engineering all the way up to the genome scale as part of the international SC2 project, which is to build a synthetic version of the yeast genome. So that's the yeast side of the work. Then we have another long-standing project, which is in collaboration with Guy Bartstan here at Imperial College, which is to try and get a handle on when you do add new genes or delete genes when you're doing synthetic biology or biotechnology, what impact does this have on the cell that is running your DNA programs? So if you want to think like an engineer, you know, you might decide to add something to a car. So you're building a car, let's say your Volkswagen, and you want to add some newfangled thing on it. I don't know, if you're Volkswagen, that might be something that can help you cheat some test so that you can rip off the world. But it might be something else a bit better, like something for for safety, like an airbag. So you would test that out, like, does it work? Is it an airbag? Great. But the other thing you would always test if you were doing this on a car would be, what is the weight of this new thing you're adding, and how does that affect the drag of the car in a wind tunnel, and all of these kind of things. So you can understand that rather than just keep adding things, you've got to add things at the right level, otherwise you're overloading the system. And then, so in this project with Guy Balstan, we've been working for 7 years now, trying to understand when you add new genes and turn them on and off for expression to get new functions, in this case in E. coli, what cost does that have to the growing E. coli cells? How does their growth rate change? Do they mutate more? And are there ways to sort of be more smart about the way you design your systems so that the load of these new genes does not have a detrimental effect?
All right.
Yeah. And so that's a nice project with a few papers already and some more coming soon. And we've been working on that a long time. It's very good for synthetic biology because it brings in like mathematical modeling and standardization and these sort of things. And then the final area of my group is now something a bit more newer in the last year or so that we've been doing, which is looking at ways to get microbes, yeast, E. coli, and other bacteria to work as groups in a population to build materials in some way or other, either to have cells send out proteins that then polymerize together to start making structures, or have bacteria that produce big carbohydrate materials that can then be changed in terms of their properties by tinkering at the DNA level in the cells that produce that. So we've started to make progress there, but that's a sort of the next sort of stage of projects in my group for a bit more for the future.
All right. I saw a lot of news about your last article about engineering baker's yeast to produce antibiotics. So can you tell us a bit more on this this new thing that
that was a great project because it gave us a chance to really look at what you can do if you can quickly take lots of standard modules of DNA, so promoters sequences that will say how much a gene is turned on or off, different versions of genes, genes that encode enzymes from different organisms, mm-hmm. And different ways of putting them together in combinations. And so we wanted to demonstrate that this sort of standardized modular assembly can be used to build new functions into cells. So we decided to work with baker's yeast because it's the standard yeast we work with in the lab and everyone's quite familiar with it. And we decided that, you know, one of the new functions we would like to bring in is producing a complex metabolic compound. And the one we looked at was penicillin. So that's a reasonably well-known beta-lactam antibiotic. And we were able to show that, you know, by bringing in the genes from different organisms and really using the ability to swap modules in and out, we could then get a usable production of penicillin from our yeast to the point where the yeast now produce enough penicillin outside the cell that the growth media that they grow in is now antibiotic. So mm-hmm. you can put it on bacteria and it stops them from growing. That was a nice achievement. For us, the project was about initially demonstrating our technology of synthetic biology. But then, in a wider sense, the project was about demonstrating that with that technology and with standardized, well understood and easy to work with organisms like baker's yeast, you have now the sort of tools to be able to bring genes in from other organisms that are much more difficult to work with, that naturally encode the sort of metabolism that will produce things like antibiotics. Why that's exciting is because there's a lot of work going on right now in people going out and sequencing everything they find, mm-hmm. microbiomes and niches out there. And that's identifying a lot of DNA sequences that appear to encode enzyme clusters that probably produce things that might have antibiotic activity. Now, a lot of that is bacteria. So there's plenty of bacteria like Streptomyces that have lots and lots of DNA that encodes things that are probably antibiotics. And people are now realizing that you can engineer Streptomyces, or you can literally take those DNA sequences from online, get them synthesized so that they're printed out for you, and start putting them into organisms that are easier to work with, like E. coli. And then if you maybe play around with them the right way, you might start making this antibiotic that you've not seen before. But actually, I'm talking there about bacteria, but fungi, mm-hmm. Like penicillium fungi, also make a lot of antibacterials. They're kind of a bit of an unexplored area. So what our project shows is that you can take genes from a fungi, and they are, you know, yeast is close enough, baker's yeast is close enough to some of these fungi, that those genes, when correctly formatted and put with the right modules, can then work in Cerevisiae yeast, baker's yeast, to produce the antibiotic. Now, we only demonstrate that in this paper for penicillin, which is one everyone knows. It's an exemplar. But what's exciting is the ability now that if we follow that same process of identifying the genes in penicillin, bringing them over and testing these things out, we may now be able to start producing other antibiotics, or maybe antibiotics people think may exist but don't know for sure, from other fungi, because lots of fungal genome sequences are being sequenced, particularly by places like Kew Gardens here in London, mm-hmm. and as those sequences become available, you know, people will look at it and say there's a chance that these DNA sequences encode the enzymes to make a new antibiotic. Well, our process that we demonstrate in that paper says what to do next, right? It is get those DNA sequences synthesized in a way that they can fit into the kit that is in baker's yeast, and then try out various combinations and see if you can start making something with antibiotic properties.
So it's an easy tool to produce new antibiotics.
Yeah,
from different organisms that usually I would say that it's
what we demonstrate is that baker's yeast can be used as the sort of test bed,
all right,
to take fungal genes, put them in combinations that can then make antibiotics. And this will help in people then identifying what genes make antibiotics, what fungi are making antibiotics, and potentially identify pathways that make new antibiotics. Baker's yeast is then, maybe you could improve it so it could then produce lots of these antibiotics, but actually, you know, industry and organic chemists are pretty good at making antibiotics without the need for yeast producing it at small yields.
And have you been in contact with industry? Because I guess some people would be interested in this kind of
in a couple of ways. So we have good partnerships with industry in the UK. So one of the big pharma companies here, GSK, sponsor research in my group. It's quite common in the UK system for PhD students to be partly sponsored by companies, and GSK are a really good partner there, looking at bringing in genes from another organism into yeast to produce a metabolite of interest for them for the production of a variety of probably anti-cancer compounds. Mm-hmm. Even I don't know for sure. They're quite secretive about that. And on the flip side as well, GSK, when in the old days they were Smith and Klein and Beecham, they were also very involved, at least in the UK, in understanding how to produce large amounts of penicillin, mm-hmm. and how to scale up the production of that. So I've had interesting conversations with my uncle, who worked in a long time ago in the 60s and tried to 60s and 70s and tried to improve the production of penicillin in their own, these big vats at, mm-hmm. GSK, well, what has now become GSK in the old days. And he thinks the production of it from yeast in these small volumes is quite laughable. But it's there as a test bed.
All right. And so what do you consider now the future of synthetic biology? What big things do you think is coming in the next couple of years?
So I think that synthetic biology's future is now going much more towards the technologies and the way of thinking of synthetic biology sort of pushing into just general research science that a lot of other people are doing. So through the advances we've done in synthetic biology, it's become much more commonplace in just research, both in academia and in biotech, to use synthesized DNA, to use things like Golden Gate DNA assembly or modular assembly. And, you know, it's not surprising that, you know, some of the main groups involved in synthetic biology, and particularly in bringing tools to synthetic biology, were also heavily involved in bringing CRISPR to be something that's usable. So groups like George Church and Keith Young and Feng Zhang in Boston were all quite, you know, working towards, like, whatever they can to be able to engineer DNA within cells on the genome. And then they were the people who really jumped up on CRISPR at some point and tried to make it as usable a tool as possible. So, you know, everywhere I go now, I would say 7 years ago when I talked about synthetic biology as an invited researcher at, you know, other institutes around the UK, people were like, okay, this looks kind of interesting. And now if I go to places, people come afterwards and say, oh yeah, we've started using Golden Gate DNA assembly and modular assembly, or we've started synthesizing rather than standard cloning, and we see all these things. So I think the foundational tools of synthetic biology are starting to sort of become a bit more of a mainstream thing. So then I guess the question is, what then happens to those of us who are developing those tools? What do we do with it next? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is to kind of really try and scale it and show what you can do when you have these tools and you've mastered them, you know, what are the more complicated things to do? So whole chromosomes, mm-hmm. As part of the synthetic yeast project, that is something that we're pursuing along with others around the world. So rather than build up systems with, you know, 5 to 10 genes like the penicillin pathway, we build up versions of entire chromosomes with a couple hundred genes on them, and see if they work to replace the natural ones. So I think realistically in the field, where people are going to go is towards larger, more complicated systems, and the natural route for that is to go towards making chromosomes and entire genomes.
And so you were talking about this project of making chromosomes. You're in collaboration with other teams that are doing other chromosomes.
Yeah.
Is there an idea of making a completely synthetic organism at the end by putting all these synthetic chromosomes into the new yeast and have a synthetic yeast?
Yeah, so the idea of the project, which is not my own idea, it was from researchers initially at Johns Hopkins University about 10 years ago, was to make a synthetic yeast, to basically take the entire yeast genome and build it up from synthesized versions and see if it can replace the natural versions that are inherited from cell to cell. And they had the ambition when they started this project to also say, well, let's not just do the, can we do it from chemical building blocks, but let's also, whilst we're doing that, put in a lot of various little changes. I wouldn't necessarily say that the outcome is going to be a synthetic cell, because it is going to, you know, be yeast cells that have gradually been turned into ones that have a genome that has been designed by humans, and at some point that DNA has been synthesized somewhere. But ultimately it will still be yeast, and actually a major part of the project is that at the end the normal cell, unless we switch certain programs on or off, should just behave like normal yeast.
All right.
and be able to be as healthy and usable as normal yeast, but then hidden within this highly edited and slightly rearranged genome are, you know, some things that basically give it hidden special powers. So that's the aim.
Wouldn't it have been easier to use another organism like bacteria?
So the synthesis, full synthesis of genomes has been achieved already by Craig Venter Institute with a small genome bacteria, actually with one that's about 1 million base pairs, and they've since taken that and rationally removed quite a lot of genes from that to narrow it down to 500,000 base pair. we prefer to work with eukaryote. It's kind of like the next level. You know, if you're gonna do something, do something up at the next level. And this is obviously a factor of 10 more DNA, because yeast genome is 10 times bigger than the mycoides bacteria genome. But actually, I have a feeling that it's a slightly easier project than doing whole bacterial genomes, because eukaryotic genomes, like yeast, they have the genes laid out with spaces between them, and everything's in sort of in separate chromosomes. So it's a little easier to make changes without disrupting the entire system. In a bacteria, typically there's one circular chromosome, mm-hmm. and it's thought of, you know, there's evidence that removing bits from the chromosome in certain areas will then disrupt the entire genome, because you're taking a chunk out of a circle and then everything gets rearranged around that circle. So I think it could, in many bacteria, synthesizing and heavily editing the genome can be quite a difficult task.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it logically, bacteria, and even more so viruses, phage, they're optimized to, you know, grow well with the minimum amount of energy use. And one of the ways they do that is making sure that every bit of DNA is used. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, small bits of DNA get used multiple times.
Like, yeah,
they encode one gene, but they also are involved in the regulation of another. So making changes when every piece of DNA counts, and in many cases counts for many things, is more difficult, whereas in a eukaryote, a lot of the DNA doesn't seem to do that much. It might have just been inherited as and it's perfectly fine to get rid of it or change it.
All right, okay. My next question would be that your lab is a fan on preprint and, I guess, open access in general. What do you see as the goal of open access in biology? You were talking earlier about sharing your resources, and
I think just the goal is just to get your research read by others so that others can use it just as quick as possible, really. Mm-hmm. The journal publication cycle is getting longer and longer, mm-hmm. and more difficult and more costly. I mean, my first papers were published 15, 16 years ago, and at the time when I started my PhD, and the turnaround time and the sort of requests for revisions back then was a lot quicker. And mm-hmm. the same journals now, you know, come back with every single reviewer asking for loads of extra experiments, whereas, you know, the same journal 10, 15 years ago, the reviewers said, okay, just change this, change that, right? So for some reason or another, and I can go into all of my pet theories about it, publication through journals has really become a slowing down barrier for science. Mm-hmm. And preprints are a way where you can get that, and they're very important, in particular for people in your research group who are on limited contracts, in many cases have visas expiring, so they need to leave. So they need to be able to get their research seen by others and be in time to be able to get their next positions. And, you know, people can't, you know, you can't have this situation that we have where, you know, okay, you're not going to get your next job unless you do this crazy long extra experiment that reviewer 3 asks for, and which requires you to come back for another 2-3 months, but you don't have a visa and you don't have any pay mm-hmm. to do that, and all of these kind of problems, right? So I don't know. I mean, I think it's very sad the way that journal publications are going with the amount of extra work required.
So what do you think they ask for this extra amount of work, and why they ask so many questions about? It's just because they really want to be sure.
So there's a couple of my pet theories are, I think the the real boost in science in the last 20 years has been the major increase in funding for biosciences over that period of time in the US system and in the Chinese system. And in both those systems, there's a big emphasis on tenure track. People have to be very highly competitive and really produce the very, you know, one or two mega papers. If you've been hired on tenure track at a very prominent university, you'll be given a very big startup package and you will be going for NIH R01s. And so they're really, you know, it really sort of pushes the bar up for everyone, that everyone's think. A lot of people are now thinking on that mindset. And I think that from the UK system, which is nothing like that, you can see how toxic it can get, that people are expected to get Cell, Science, Nature papers, R01s, patents. And so they play this game of effectively getting a big startup money, spending all that on everything they need to be big enough to get their first big grant, and their paper will be all timed to come out. So people are playing this sort of big long game. And I think that, you know, people are then expecting too much out of some research projects because of that. That's one pet theory. The one which I've heard a lot is that, you know, a lot of publications now are actually not, when they do get reviewed by journals, it's not the PIs that are reviewing them. You know, the PIs give them to their PhD students and postdocs to do the review for them and then help them through. And, you know, PhDs, students are sort of, when they look through a paper, they're far more picky. You know, they get trained by, you know, these journal clubs that departments run to do everything they can to try and find problems with papers and say what they like, what they dislike much more than what they like. And I think that's causing a lot of problems now, in that people expect too much out of publications. And I think we need to do a better job of training our own researchers when they're doing reviews to be a bit more sort of fair and relaxed about about the review process.
All right. So yeah, in the past you have supervised IGN teams for Imperial, and you won awards for that. What was it like to be part of this competition?
So it's a really great competition. It takes up your time, so it's not to be taken lightly, and it costs money. And it's can be a real big pressure on the students who do it, and yourself, partly because once you start and you realize, and particularly this happens here at Imperial, and I also saw it as when supervising a team at Cambridge, when the project starts working and seems to be good, then the students get so into it that they really, because they're a team, they really, and there's a deadline and a competition, they really end up putting a lot of pressure on themselves to try and be the very, very best they can. And we've reaped rewards from that, winning prizes and ending up with really good students out of that as well. But it is pretty intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is the outcome of these competitions good for the student? Does it learn a lot during doing that? Is it not too much competition? What do you think?
We tend to obviously get a pick of some good students at Imperial, and previously as well at Cambridge, when I supervised a team there. So we tend to get good students coming in to the team, and we can pick ones that we think will work best together and work best. But the quality that they're at when they leave is outstanding. They get such amazing training that many of them are now doing successful PhDs. Some have gone on to postdocs. There are people who did iGEM projects who are now running their own research groups, and in the case here at Imperial, we have several startup companies that are pretty successful now, that have raised, you know, excess of £1 million of funding, that are iGEM students, following up from stuff they did in their iGEM projects, and commercializing that now. So we really see amazing students come out of it. We have good students go in, but the standard when they come out of iGEM is very, very good.
Perfect. And what were some of the projects you supervised?
So the two projects at Imperial that I was the main supervisor of, one of them was one called Project Auxin, where the idea was to reprogram E. coli cells so that they would sense metabolites like malate and swim towards them. These are metabolites that are released by roots as the roots are starting to grow in soil, and this would then mean that the roots would then encapsulate the bacteria, because growing roots are known to sort of feed on, encapsulate bacteria and then feed upon them, and the bacteria would then have a program in them that produced a plant hormone that would promote more branched growth of the roots. So the idea was this bacteria could be put with the seeds, and then as the plants grow, because the bacteria are there, these plants, which themselves would not be genetically modified, they would be promoted by the bacteria to grow their roots in a much more branched and elongated fashion, branched fashion that would hold the soil together better. So okay. The idea was, like, how could you plant seeds in loose soil when normally erosion would just wash them away? That was back in 2012 or 2011. Yeah. And then more recently in 2014, I supervised a team that worked with bringing synthetic biology tools to a type of bacteria called Acetobacter, which convert sugars into large amounts of bacterial cellulose, which is this kind of very ultra pure version of cellulose that can be useful in lots of different applications. And they showed that they could bring a whole toolkit of DNA parts from E. coli over into these bacteria and be able to do things like have the bacteria sense a signal and then produce, as they're producing this material, put fluorescence within the material. Or put proteins within the material that then can bind things. So that was our sort of our initiation into the world of materials from synthetic biology. And that came from the genius of some of these students who come up with the ideas, and a few of them now are running a startup company based on that.
So the idea are coming from the students at the beginning?
Yeah. So
it's not you as a supervisor that come with
every,
an idea?
The way we run the projects is that the students are basically stuck in a room and told, okay, come up with an idea for a project that's amazing, that's feasible, that's innovative, that stands a chance of winning. Come up with five ideas by the end of Wednesday, run them by us, and then we cycle over a week or two of going backwards and forwards. But every year, it's always the students who do the ideas. We don't have any policy of us forcing ideas on the students. Sometimes the students really are saying, come on, just tell us what to do. No. It has to be your thing.
Okay. Which is good, I think.
Yeah.
So as I say, you're an Agin depositor, and as well you're a member of Agin's advisory board. So what do you hope to achieve as a member of the board, and what are you doing in the board? Explain a bit.
So I think I was invited onto the board because I was one of the first people talking about AdGene and depositing with AdGene in Europe back, you know, 5-6 years ago. It's obviously AdGene has a good footprint around the world now, but I'd heard of AdGene from my time in Boston, and actually more recently one of the founders of AdGene spent time in as a researcher in the research group where I'd been in Boston as well, so there's a link there. I was aware from my friends who were doing synthetic biology projects in the US of the value of putting your plasmids on AdGene for other people to use. That's obviously a key thing that we're trying to do in synthetic biology, is build modular kits that other people can use so that we can build upon each other's work. And so that's why I was interested in depositing in AdGene, because that's very much a goal of our work. And in terms of being a member of the board, I like it's light touch. It's nice. But, you know, I like to be able to provide some advice to the board based on the way synthetic biology is going.
Yeah.
So what would people really like in synthetic biology? I think a goal that a lot of us would love to see happen would be the ability to sort of get the plasmid you want totally synthesized and sent to you within 2 days. The whole plasmid. Like, in the same way that you can order DNA primers and 2 days later, 3 days later, they arrive in a bag. It'd be lovely to have the plasmid you want, right? And I've discussed with Adgene about, will synthesis replace sharing of plasmids through Adgene? It seems no for now. I think yes in the future would be a lovely thing, but then Adgene should hopefully would be well placed to be the people who advise and provide the sequences. I'm sure Adgene at some point would quite like a business model where rather than have to do all of these mini preps and store all of these plasmids, they literally just print them out and send them to people from the DNA sequences.
Could be interesting, yeah.
Synthetic biology and bioengineering hold great promise for the development of new biological tools for research, therapeutic, and industrial applications. We can't wait to see what the future holds. To learn more about exciting developments in the biological sciences, be sure to subscribe to the Agene Podcast, a better way to share science.